from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. California is entering its fourth year of drought. Last week, Governor Jerry Brown proposed a billion-dollar plan to take it on. But it will take heroic efforts, more than money, to fill California's parched reservoirs, to save its groundwater, to see a real snowpack again. If it can be done, everything is on the table this hour on Point, California's deepening water challenge. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How low can the water go without fundamental change in California? Is the answer in conservation, technology, moving vans? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in this hour from an expert on desalination and from the eminent California historian, Kevin Starr. Let's hear first from the California governor. Here is Jerry Brown on Wednesday announcing a plan to spend more than $1 billion in bond money for drought relief, describing the problem here in the most basic terms: too many people living in a desert.
We all face a challenge because California, for 10,000 years, had only 300,000 or so residents. When you up that number to 38 million, and you increase the amenities and the consumption, you get a problem when you're in the middle of a desert.
A problem in the middle of a desert and in the middle of a drought. And it could get worse. NASA estimates out that we could see mega droughts in this century of 30 or 40 years. Here's NASA's Ben Cook talking in February to the Washington Post about how mega droughts will hit the United States.
Recent droughts, such as the ongoing drought in California or in the Southwest, or even historical droughts such as the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, these are naturally occurring droughts that typically last several years or sometimes almost a decade. In our projections, what we're seeing is that with climate change, many of these types of droughts will likely last for 20, 30, sometimes even 40 years.
Hello, climate change. Joining me now from Berkeley, California is Heather Cooley, Water Program Director at the Pacific Institute, which researches water shortage, habitat destruction, climate change. Heather Cooley, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
So we're reading here that several of the bigger reservoirs actually have more water than they did a year ago, maybe 25-28% full, smaller ones down, snowpack way down at 12%. How much of California's water comes one way or another from that snowpack, Heather?
Snowpack is a critical reservoir for California. It captures the water in the wintertime when demand is fairly low, and then it releases it in the spring and through the summer when demand increases. So it is a critical part of California's water system, and the fact that it is as low as it is certainly problematic for much of California.
In climate terms, weather terms, what has taken the snowpack down to 12%? I mean, that's almost 90% gone.
We really have not had much rain, frankly, in California. And the rain that has occurred has been mostly in our coastal areas. We did have some heavy downpours in December, for example, mm-hmm. and some of those regions saw a boost in their local supplies. But for much of the state, we rely on imported water, and that water ultimately comes from the snowpack. So it's been problematic. It's not a function of the fact that we've had the warm weather. Certainly, that can reduce snowpack as well. But there really just has not been any precipitation in the mountain areas.
How's that explained? Is it a Pacific wind pattern thing, Heather? Is it El Nino, something else?
Well, there's a high-pressure ridge system that's sitting off the coast of California, the ridiculously resilient ridge, as it's been termed, and that has been pushing storms both to the north and to the south. So it's sitting off the coast. This is the same system, really, that had been there last year and led to the very dry 2014.
So here comes Jerry Brown. You've got, two or three weeks left in the rainy season this year. You know, let's cross our fingers. You could have some tremendous deluge, though that can create its own flooding problems. But you can't count on that now. I've got plenty of family in California, and they've been saying after last week's announcement from the governor and more, there's a sense, maybe for the first time among a lot of Californians, that this is real, that this is going to begin to bite into their lives. What's he proposing that may hit at the citizen level?
Well, what the governor is proposing is a billion-dollar bond, and just to be clear, there was a package also in 2014 that was around $700 million. So this is considerably more than that. Some of the funds, nearly two-thirds of the funds, would be used for flood control projects. The governor argues that these are really needed to due to the increased likelihood of extreme weather events from climate change. But the remainder of the term, some of them will be used for sort of short-term emergency relief, for sort of food and housing assistance for communities impacted by the drought. Some of the funds will be used for projects that will take time to come online, but will provide a more long-term benefit. So those would include recycled water or desalination projects. And some of the funds will be used for efficiency improvements, which can be implemented very quickly and provide both short-term and long-term benefits.
How long can California go with this drought circumstance? How much can, with technology, desalination, we're going to talk about that in a minute. You got the Pacific Ocean sitting there. Conservation and cutbacks. I mean, we don't know. Here's NASA talking about 30 or 40 year droughts later in this century. Hopefully this one's about finished, but you don't know for sure. How long can California go?
Well, that's a good question, and it some degrees depends upon how we manage the water resources that we have. So it will take a tremendous reduction in the amount of water that we use. So we need to be using more efficiently. Now, the good news is there's a lot more we can be doing and should be doing. It'll certainly drive efficiency, which is a good thing. But frankly, in California, we in many areas use water once, and then we dump it into oceans or estuaries. We can be recycling and reusing that water, and we could be capturing the water that does fall in California. We could be capturing that and then using it. There's a lot of potential for stormwater capture. I know, hard to think about in a drought, but it has rained and it will rain certainly again.
Here's the governor last week, Jerry Brown, saying this is not going to be easy. Some pain on the way.
When you're piling a huge battleship, it turns slowly in the water. And our agencies are doing, they see it. And certainly I will up the pressure, but I don't always like to second guess. But people are going to do more, and it's going to be painful.
Heather Cooley is with us from Berkeley, California. Heather, how's the change or the pain, depending how you want to look at it, likely to have to be apportioned? Who takes what? How much is change required of agriculture, 70 or 80% of water consumption in California, business, private citizens?
So ultimately, the share of the pain is determined by the State Water Resources Control Board, and that's sort of their job. What they've already done for urban areas is to implement some restrictions, and they just recently increased those restrictions. So now in many areas, throughout the state, there are limits on the number of days that you can water, on the times you can water.
Lawn, are you saying, or crops, or what?
Oh, I'm sorry, for lawns.
Okay.
This is in urban areas. Mm-hmm. In agricultural areas, what you'll see and what you have been seeing, here we have a prioritization of water rights. So you have senior water rights holders and junior water rights holders. And junior water rights holders is likely that they may not get water. The pain sort of goes up the prioritization chain over time. In those areas, you will see, and we have seen fallowing. You'll see more groundwater pumping, certainly, and we have seen that as well. In some cases, record levels of groundwater pumping. And so there is.
And you hear
pain
you're really
there.
Talking about agriculture in terms of senior and junior. And when you say fallow, you mean fields that are just left without crops in them, groundwater. Because it's not up top, so they go down. How much more groundwater can they drain off without endangering that sort of last resource?
Well, that's one of the fundamental, I think, problems, is that we have been over-reliant on groundwater in average years, and we have been drawing down that very important reservoir such that it's not there to the extent or to the degree that we now need it. There has been last year, there was passage of a groundwater management regulations for the first time in California that does require locals to better manage groundwater, and that is certainly tremendous progress. But it's not that law wouldn't be implemented for 20 years. And so it's not clear that we can wait that long.
I'm reading here in the Sacramento Bee, they're quoting a geologist saying, if you look at this current situation, it says, if it doesn't rain very soon, you've got one whale of a problem. Do you really want to take the chance of having to evacuate Southern California if it doesn't rain? This is a geologist who's working on water issues. Are people taking that kind of concern seriously, Heather?
Well, I think in the past year, no, that it hasn't been taken as seriously. But I do think, as you mentioned, people are starting to realize how severe this drought is. In many areas, they are dependent on imported water supplies, and so they aren't very connected to the sources of their water. I think the fact that it's been widely announced how low snowpack is, how low the reservoirs are, that people are beginning to wake up to the challenges ahead of us. That being said, changing behavior can be difficult. We need to educate people. We need to give them tools so they know how to reduce their use or better manage their resources. And we need to communicate through price signals. We need to ensure that our pricing structures are promoting efficiency.
What's the buffer look like? I mean, here you are headed into a fourth year. If you want to change people's behavior, that doesn't happen overnight. Are things lining up, Heather? I mean, could you start hitting real walls in terms of water supply before people and processes are ready to change adequately to deal with the shortage?
Well, certainly some communities are without water and are in many cases drilling deeper wells, in some cases relying on bottled water to be trucked in. These tend to be smaller rural communities. In your urban areas, the situation is not quite so severe. Many communities in California did take the lessons from past droughts. They have built other types of supply. They have diversified their portfolio. They are using recycled water. They are using alternatives. Now, they need to be doing more of that, and certainly this is the opportunity to educate people about that and move forward.
Do you feel like this is all going to hold together? You've got 38 million people. You've got going on 4 years of drought now. Are you on track to manage this without major disruption?
Well, as bad as the situation is, I'm hopeful that we have a lot of opportunities before us through efficiency, through reuse, through stormwater capture, in some cases potentially through desalination. There's a lot of opportunity there. It's just a matter of getting the political will to move forward.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about California's new season of water woes as a big drought moves into its fourth year there, what the most populous state in America may have to do to survive. Heather Cooley joins us from the Pacific Institute in Berkeley, California. We're going to talk desalination in a moment. There's the whole Pacific Ocean. That's a lot of water. Of course, it's very salty. Here was the governor last week, Jerry Brown, talking about efficiency and needing to do more different things.
We have to be more elegant and more efficient. We are a society that uses a lot of stuff, a lot of electricity, a lot of natural gas, a lot of oil, a lot of water. And we have to up our game to be more efficient. And if the drought continues, we're going to have to be incredibly innovative to be able to keep our current lifestyle going.
That lifestyle, as he says, has a lot of pieces to it, and many of them involve water. Just things as simple as watering lawns. Californians haven't most of them, had to cut back on that yet. Here's a Santa Clara Valley Water District spokesman, Nick Esquivel, talking about homeowners and how they may complain about new restrictions on water usage.
If you're used to, 20 years I've been watering my lawn every day or every other day, it's hard to break that habit. But with watering it deeper, you can do it less frequently.
Nature may be changing a lot of habits for Californians. Governor Brown talking about weather patterns, climate change, the long-term picture. Questions and comments for you here, Heather. Mike in Austin, Texas. Mike, thank you for calling. Texas knows something about drought lately. What do you think, Mike?
Hi. I was going to comment on the fundamental. To give you some background, I actually worked with the Drought Preparedness Council here in Texas during the drought 2011 to about 2013.
Yeah.
And what struck me fundamentally is that we're talking about technology and all these other things, but we really need to really look at is the fundamental legal structure of how water is done. Meaning your commenter was talking about senior rights and junior rights when it comes to the ownership of water. And then when you talk about groundwater, the ability, what they call the right of capture, meaning I own a piece of land, I drill a hole, I pump out as much water as I can. No one can stop me, regardless of how it affects our neighbors or the reservoirs that are underneath it. And when I spoke with the National Defense Natural Resources Commissioner from Israel, their take on water is every drop of water that falls in Israel belongs to the state of Israel, and they allocate it accordingly. similarly, in Australia, the first thing they did to deal with their lack of water was all the states gave up their right to water. So fundamentally, I think technology and all these other things, there's no ability to manage the water until we finally attack that legal aspect that comes from England, common law.
Mike, let us pick it up with Heather in California. Heather, what about it? Let's back upstream here to the legal structure itself. How important is that in your view in dealing with this drought and what may lie ahead?
Well, I certainly agree that it's not just about technology. There is much, much more to it, and the legal structure is certainly part of it. The pricing structure is certainly part of it, and certainly just our governance structures in general. So, you know, in Australia, it was really the millennium drought. It was a 10 or 12 year drought that they had that really fundamentally pressured or pushed them into revisiting how they allocate water. That could be something we see in California, certainly. That was driven in part by the junior water rights holder that we're continuing to get essentially nothing. That could be something we see if this drought does go on.
What about California agriculture when it comes to that? If you change the legal structure that favors a lot of agriculture now, and of course the urban areas, but how much of California's enormous agricultural output can go on steady state, Heather? Or are we already seeing deep cuts in the output?
Well, agriculture in California, if you look at human uses of water, agriculture accounts for about 80% of that, and our urban areas are about 20%. So they do use a large amount of water, but they are farming and growing a lot of crops. They're growing a lot of food and fiber for Californians, for the rest of the world.
I was reading somebody saying when you go to the produce aisle in the supermarket and pick up your vegetables for the week, you're essentially drinking California water.
Yes, to some degree, and certainly we in California are drinking water from other places through some of the products that we consume. Mm-hmm. Certainly, it will lead to a shift. It'll lead to a shift in what we grow in the state and how we grow. We're already seeing that. We're already seeing a transition away from some of the lower value water intensive crops towards higher value crops. We're seeing a shift away from flood irrigation towards drip and in micro sprinklers. So those transitions are happening. But when we look around, we still see that most crops grown in the state are the water-intensive, lower-value crops, that flood irrigation is still the single most common irrigation method. So while we are making those shifts, we can do much more, we can do much better, and we have to do much better.
Alan in Madison, Wisconsin. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. A couple really quick comments. First of all, I was on a business trip last month out to Vegas.
Yeah.
And for the first time in 22 years or so, I actually made a quick trip to the Hoover Dam, and I couldn't believe what I saw. I remember what I saw when I was there the last time. It was basically full. This time it was almost half empty, it looked like, at least from the vantage point I had. Just kind of shocking to me. But the main point that I called about was, I really think that the solution, you kind of touched upon at the very beginning when your introduction is, I think the solution might sadly have to be for California is, the moving ban. There's just either cut agriculture way back, or too many people in an arid desert environment that want to live the 20th century, 21st century lifestyle. I just don't think it's going to work long term, especially if those 20, 40 year droughts you mentioned. It's just conservation's not going to do it.
Alan, it's a radical view, but we may be in radical circumstances. Let me pick it up, if I may, with Heather. Heather, how about it? We heard the governor saying there, look, California hosted 300,000 some people for a long time, historically. Now it's got 38 million. Some people say it's actually during this period in which its population has grown so much, it's actually been in a historically lush kind of wet cycle. If it's going drier and if climate change is helping push that, what about that baseline population? Is it sustainable, Heather?
Well, I think we certainly need to do a better job of connecting land use policy and the level of development with water availability. That is something we haven't done well in the past, and we need to get better. That being said, if we look at household use, for example, in California, the average person uses 140 gallons per day, and that's in their homes. There are other, obviously, urban uses and, of course, uses for agriculture. But if we look at Australia, for example, they're using around 54 gallons per person per day, so far less than half of what we are using. So there's an opportunity in California to be using less to accommodate population growth. Certainly, we need to think about that within the future of climate change, but we could be doing much better. We could comfortably have a robust, resilient agricultural sector, a healthy agricultural sector, while also meeting the needs of our growing populations and our ecosystems. I think that's an important part as well. But we need to be using water much more efficiently, and we can. If we look at our urban areas, about half of water use in urban areas is for outdoors. It's for landscaping, and in many places we aren't using that. It's ornamental lawn that no one has ever stepped on, except to mow. So there's a lot of opportunity there, and then looking at reuse.
Heather, you are so politic and diplomatic and well-spoken. But when you're sitting around, without the microphones on at the Pacific Institute, do you all think you can sustain 38 million people in California? Can you see population growth? When you look at these trends that are being outlined for this century, NASA says we may have 30 to 40-year droughts. Like, talk turkey with us here. Is it sustainable? We know a lot better, but is it sustainable?
Well, I think it may be surprising if you look at water use in California. It's actually less than it was 30 years ago. If you look at your major cities, San Francisco, mm-hmm. Los Angeles, they're using less water today than they were in the 1980s, despite population growth. I think the good news is that they can be doing a lot better than they are currently. And it's this drought, along with a growing awareness about climate change, that's going to accelerate and incentivize that.
Luke in Chicago. Luke, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
My comment, Jerry Brown mentioned it quite eloquently. If we are to, his words were, if we are to maintain our current lifestyle, and that's, this is a serious crisis. They're going to have to implement major austerity measures across the board. And everybody needs to come together and make it happen.
Water austerity. What are you looking at for solutions, Luke?
Well, on a previous show last week, they were talking about running a pipeline out of the Midwest, which is a great idea. I was in Kentucky, the Kentucky-Indiana border. There's a river, and it's just massively overflowed. Worst I've seen. It happens every year, but it's the worst I've ever seen.
Luke, let me pick it up right there. The pipeline from the Midwest, from the Mississippi. I mean, we've got to be careful. I remember years when the Mississippi was so low itself, you could practically walk across it. I was down in Cairo, Illinois, and could easily have made that swim. Didn't, but could have. But Heather, people have heard about this idea lately of sticking a straw in the Mississippi or other waterways in the Midwest and running a pipeline out to California. Is that pie in the sky or real?
Well, there's some practical and then some political considerations there. I think on the practical level, a gallon of water weighs 8 pounds. And so moving that water that distance would require a tremendous amount of energy, not to mention the infrastructure, really.
You've got to get over the Continental Divide, the Rockies.
Correct. And mm-hmm. so that would be incredibly expensive. We should be, and there are many things we can do before having to go to those sort of extremes. So that one's probably not likely. There are also the political considerations in that people like to keep water local. They're not going to just be willing to sort of part with that water, even in areas where flooding is problematic, at least now.
I mean, we don't know exactly what climate change will produce. Maybe there's an excess of water in the Midwest today, but look 30 years down the road, it's hard to say. Let's look at desalination. Yoram Cohen joins us right now from Los Angeles, professor of chemical and biomolecular in engineering at University of California, Los Angeles. Works on advanced solutions for water treatment and desalination. We're reading, Yoram Cohen, about a giant desalination plant coming on stream soon in San Diego that will provide something like 7% of San Diego's, is it drinking water, Professor Cohen?
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
We're talking about certainly drinking water is the major usage.
And is this a solution overall for California? I'm looking at headlines talking about Israel now getting 40% of its water from the sea. there's the Pacific Ocean. Is it a practical answer to California's water problem or not?
I think we have to be clear that desalination is a solution to increasing our water portfolio, but it's primarily high-quality water that would serve us for drinking water for potable use. It's not the type of water that we would want to use for agricultural purposes. So when we hear about 40% in Israel, this is 40% that is used primarily for high-quality potable water. And in California, we would expect that we can, in fact, make some of that difference that is needed, primarily for urban areas for drinking water use.
And it's not practical for agriculture because what? It's too expensive to run the osmosis equipment that produces the drinkable water?
What we have to remember, Tom, is that water has to be brought from the source to the location where it is used. So if one desalt water in the sea, you still would have to convey this water to the agricultural fields, and at that point you're paying an extra cost for that water. So add that to the cost of water desalination, and you're raising the price. So in that sense, it is not really the most practical approach, specifically since I believe that Heather mentioned a little while ago that we're talking about roughly 80% of California water that is used for agriculture, and to expect that desalination would supply that is just not realistic.
Professor Cohen, there's also an issue here, as I understand it, when you desalinate, about half the water then ends up salt-free and can flow for drinking water. That's lovely, I guess, but it's expensive. It's energy-intensive to run this, and half the water is now super salty and goes back into the sea. If you don't deal carefully with that, it can create enormous dead zones, I'm reading, sir.
Tom, I think that there's a little bit of a misconception when people say expensive. I think you have to say expensive relative to what? In the large plants around the world, in Israel and Australia, the cost of water desalination, that is seawater, we're talking about somewhere between, say, 50 cents to a dollar for 1,000 liters. People still are willing to buy bottled water that will cost $1 to $3 to $4 per liter. So when you look at it kind of overall in terms of drinking water, it's really not that expensive.
But I'm looking at numbers here for San Diego County. They say the water will cost $2,257 per acre foot, almost double, about double the price of the most expensive current supply, which comes from Sacramento, the San Joaquin Delta, 400 miles north.
Yes, but we need to distinguish between the cost that it actually takes to produce the water and the cost for other elements. In the San Diego plant, for example, it took somewhere around 8 years or maybe more to just get the permits, and the cost of building the plant in that sense was very, very expensive. So I think we also have to realize that it is important whether you build a large plant or a small plant or distributed plants. Obviously, capital costs for the large plants can be very expensive, although the operating cost is down. So that really depends. I think that if you look at what they pay in Israel, they pay a lot less than they pay in San Diego.
And then there's the issue of wildlife. If you try to suck all this water in, can you do it without damaging sea life along the California coast?
That's a very good point and a concern that has to be met. But I'd like to point out that any process, any industrial project that one has to implement or deploy has to go through very strict environmental impact analysis, and one has to ensure that such project processes are environmentally compatible. And desalination is not any different. And what they've been doing over the last few decades is improving the technology for what I would say we could call dispersion. In other words, you take the concentrate and you disperse it such that the local effects of increased salinity are not going to have an adverse impact.
Yoram Cohen at UCLA, joining us from Los Angeles. Thank you very much, Professor Cohen. We're looking at California's water crisis. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about California's new season of water woes as a big drought moves into its fourth year. A billion-dollar plan put forward by the governor there, Jerry Brown, last week to deal with this. But you can't buy rain, at least not enough, to deal with what California's up against right now. Heather Cooley's here from the Pacific Institute in Berkeley, California. Last October, KABC's Greg Lee went to Carlsbad, California, near San Diego, to report on the $1 billion desalination plant going up there.
This busy construction site along the coast of Carlsbad could help solve California's serious and historic drought. By the fall of 2015, the largest desalination plant in the Western Hemisphere will pump out 50 million gallons of water a day, supplying San Diego County with nearly 10% of its need.
We'll ask Heather Cooley about that avenue. Of course, while California wrestles with this, there's still just the big wrestling match in this country about climate change itself. Ted Cruz has announced today, formally, he's running for president. He talked with NBC's Seth Meyers about global warming. Here's the tape.
I just came back from New Hampshire where there's snow and ice everywhere. And my view actually is simple. Debates on this should follow science and should follow data. And many of the alarmists on global warming, they got a problem because the science doesn't back them up.
Well, California is alarmed. Jerry Brown wasn't willing to tie everything directly to climate change right now, but here he was on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, responding to those remarks by now formal presidential candidate Ted Cruz.
That man betokens such a level of ignorance and a direct falsification of the existing scientific data. It's shocking, and I think that man has rendered himself absolutely unfit to be running for office.
Governor Jerry Brown not mincing words on Ted Cruz and climate change. Heather Cooley, how do you sit what's going on in California right now in the context of climate change? There's obviously been cycles of drought and water plenty over eons, but how do you see what's going on right now?
That's a great question, and one where there is a lot of research and studies that have come out looking specifically at this drought. One of the things that they have noticed that yes, precipitation does vary. In fact, California has the most variable precipitation, where just a few storms going north really makes the difference between a wet and a dry year. So yes, that is part of our climate. What is new and unique is the coupling of that with the extreme temperatures that we're seeing. So 2014 was the hottest year on record. January of 2015 was also hot. So it's really this increased temperature that's exacerbating the lack of rain.
President Obama looking at big federal changes, ordering the federal government last week, the same day that Jerry Brown was talking about water in California, ordering federal government operations to reduce greenhouse gases that they put out by 40% just in the coming few years ahead. Jerry Brown saying, hey, this is serious, and we shouldn't be debating this. We shouldn't be fighting steps like that. We should be embracing them. Here's Jerry Brown again.
This is a serious matter. We're experiencing it in California as kind of a foretaste, but there is no doubt that into the future, we're going to have more problems, and we have to do something, and President Obama is taking some important steps.
Right.
And to fight that, it borders on the immoral.
Let's go to Cindy, calling from Salem, Wisconsin. Cindy, hi. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just have a comment or a question about this plant that they're supposed to be building in San Diego. With the Fukushima nuclear power plant that went down in Japan and all that seawater going in there and coming out radioactive, what are they going to do about that water?
I guess it's a long way to Fukushima, but then things do travel. Heather Cooley, what about desalination? You hear Yoram Cohen's take on it there. How big or small a part of the answer should it be, and specifically to this question about water safety?
Well, I think the radiation, there have been some detections of radiations related to Fukushima, but it's been very low level, and it's not to the degree that it would affect desalination plants here in California. Desalination is certainly one option, but as was mentioned, it needs to be looked at within the range of options that are available. It's generally more expensive. It has more social and environmental impacts than some of the other alternatives for efficiency, reuse, those types of alternatives. But it is an option that's there. We know it works. But there is a real danger because of its high cost in building a plant that's either too large or building it before you need it. We've seen that in California. We've seen that in Australia. So, in the 87-92 drought, which was also a very severe drought for California, Santa Barbara built a desalination plant in 1991. That plant was up, was online, and as soon as it was brought online, it started raining. And that plant was then turned off, never turned on again. And it's now an old technology. It's more than 25 years old. So that was a tremendous cost to that community, and one that really never provided any real benefits. Likewise, in Australia, they too had a severe drought, as I mentioned. They built 6 desalination plants, and they've shut down 4 of them, again, because it's too expensive and they have a cheaper alternative. So it's important, the technology does work, and in some communities it is an important sort of component of their water supply portfolio, but it's important to do the cheaper, faster things first.
One more call, then I want to bring on the eminent California historian Kevin Starr to think together about how Californians are looking at this. Vicki in Cleveland, Ohio. Vicki, you're on. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I was wondering, how can the state deal with corporations, or whatever you want to call them? As far as fracking is concerned, they use copious amounts of water and they contaminate the aquifers, and Nestle Bottling Company is still drawing water, I understand. Is there anything the state can do to curb that behavior?
Let's take it to Heather. Heather, what about it? We've heard these stories about Nestle and others, I think, sort of putting big pipes in the ground and sucking out lots of water to bottle and sell. Then there's fracking, which is a reputation as an enormous water user. What about those two private operations?
Well, fracking in California is a bit it is happening. It's a bit different than is happening in other parts of the country, and is much, much less water intensive. In fact, an order of magnitude less water than fracking operations in other parts.
Because it's vertical fracking, I think I heard the governor say they're not having to go out in all directions, or why?
That's exactly right. These are shallower wells. They're vertical. They're not these very deep, long horizontal wells, and so they use much less water. There are issues and concerns around water contamination, and so it is something that regulators in California are looking at and are looking at with increasing intensity. But there are many commercial uses of water in California, including agriculture. I mean, that too is a business and a commercial use of water. It's important that they too act as water stewards. And in many cases, we are seeing some innovative actions from these groups. But we can see more, and certainly we will see more as this drought continues.
Heather Cooley, please stand by in Berkeley with us right now. From San Francisco is California historian Kevin Starr, one of the preeminent historians of the state. He's written 8 books in his series, Americans and the California Dream, including California History, which is out with a new afterword right now. Kevin Starr, welcome back to On Point. It's wonderful to speak with you again.
Tom, it's good to be with you.
How do you see what's going on now being taken on board by Californians? Are people looking around at this now going into 4 years of drought and saying, we have to fundamentally grapple with this, or is it a state of denial? How do you see it, sir?
Well, Tom, I think the first thing we have to do is to pay attention to the fact that if the founding pilgrims had landed in Santa Monica Bay rather than Boston Bay, Massachusetts Bay, we'd have about 6 states out here. California extends more or less from Maine to Georgia.
Yep.
It's a complex nation state. And this is a nation state that in the early part of the 21st century ran out of electricity and then had to revive its electrical culture. And then just a few short years ago, we ran out of money. And we were in debt, and the newspapers were chronicling the impending financial collapse of California.
Yes, I remember.
And Governor Brown took that challenge up with Proposition 30 in November 2012, And California now has balanced its budget. It's making its last payments on the $15 billion that it borrowed since 2002 to cover budget deficits. And it's in the we're in the process now of repaying $1 billion borrowed from schools and community colleges, as well as another $533 million owed to local governments. Now, the reason I stress that is to suggest that it takes California time to gear up and to approach a problem on a statewide level. When it does it very effectively. Governor Brown has proven himself very effective in bailing us out of the financial situation, and now his very dramatic leadership on this level is very on the state level is very important as well. Don't forget that the vitality of California, given its size and its programs, today we've heard programs referencing to San Diego and the Bay Area,
yeah,
different parts of the interior. There's a real local preparation that's going on now. But you're asking California to take a statewide point of view on a complex problem that is, as Heather points out, is profoundly political as well. And that's going to take a little time to assemble a package, a branding of the program on a statewide basis. We're just in the process of assembling that now.
I mean, debt and money and bonds, you can roll over, you can mess around with, you can play games. Water is a little tougher, isn't it? I mean, is the state taking on board the scale of its challenge? Do you have people speaking about it in adequately serious terms on a wide scale?
It's very difficult, Tom, to face a transformational possibility. For instance, as Governor Brown suggested earlier in your program, the state was inhabited by some 300,000 Native Americans for a long time.
Yep.
And we were talking until very recently of having at least 50 million people in California by 2040. And that conversation has receded because certain kinds of population limitations based on water are emerging in the collective consciousness of California. Now, it emerged way ahead of time in John Wesley Powell's report from the arid regions in the 1870s, when he pointed out for the first time that if we're going to settle the arid regions and make states like California, they're going to be reaching certain population limits. It has taken us such this amount of time to say perhaps, and now we're saying this has come up four or five times in our conversations, that perhaps there's a limitation to what California can be. Now, that's, if we look at the other national policies that are going on in the United States, it's very complex. This is hardly a nation today that can come up with A, B, C, D, E programs on any number of things and where there's not deep political division, confusion, and alternatives. And California is, all things considered, on a local level, has been long since working on this water issue. The question now is to bring it up to statewide consciousness at a time when statewide awareness in California is and national awareness in the United States is particularly difficult.
Maybe thirst will be the thing that drives clarity at some point. Kevin Starr, Heather Cooley, questions for the two of you here from Tucson, Arizona. Jack is calling. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah. Is there a with this kind of with this level of drought, is there any way that this might exacerbate the risk of earthquakes there? You know, they got fault lines and geological disturbances for decades and decades.
Let's pick. Heather, is there a connection between water, maybe groundwater, and seismic activity, or no?
I haven't seen any research on that. I mean, I think there's a possibility, but very unlikely. I mean, the depths at which many of these earthquakes are occurring is much deeper than where the groundwater is being taken from.
Garl in Waterloo, Iowa. Garl, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to state the obvious problem here, and it's not desalination with water in the oceans. It's people. We got way too many people on this planet. And if we don't take care of it soon, people are going to die due to loss of resources. So my opinion on the fact is we need some sort of population control. And I'm not saying that's a good idea, because no one wants to hear that, but what has to be done needs to be done.
Let's put it to... Yeah, Carl, I appreciate your call. Kevin Starr, you're talking about what was very recently a kind of expectation, maybe even a goal for California to be at 50 million residents by 2040. It's at 38 million now. If California is taking its foot off that accelerator or that expectation.
Yes, I think our recent speaker hits a very good point. This is a global problem, how much water on the planet,
yeah.
how it can be deployed, and what the natural population of the planet is. California is negotiating this complexity here now in the midst of carrying on a day-to-day activity that has resulted in our re-energized economy reached $2.2 trillion in gross state product about 18 months ago. So this is not as if we've stopped everything to renegotiate, but we are basically saying to ourselves, historically, we're beginning to say to ourselves on a statewide basis, look it, we invented ourselves through water, we implemented ourselves through water, and now we're going to have to reinvent ourselves for water as we did in the 19th and 20th century.
Do you think Californians are getting into the state of mind to follow Australia and maybe cut their water use by half or more to deal with what's going on?
Well, we got our water culture from Australia. We looked to Australia as early as the 1860s and 70s, especially the 1870s and 80s, in terms of the history of water engineering in California. And the linkage between Australia and California in terms of similarity, as Governor Brown suggested, the semi-arid and desert regions, I think, is very hopeful. And with this one world concept today, as solutions in Australia, we mentioned earlier that the whole restructuring of water ownership is perhaps an issue that will be developing over time. But if you're talking about something like that, you're talking about something that takes 20, 30, 40, 50 years in terms of political development. The point that California is facing now on a local level is, and it has been for some time, as all these suggestions on the program show, is also being reinforced on a level of domestic consumption. For instance, a recent film made by Jane Fonda, Becoming California, Environmental Change on America's Western Edge, the film really shows the fact that unless we do this, unless we reform ourselves, unless we restructure our water culture, there won't be much of a California to reinvent, or at least we'll begin to recede from a bellwether state to a sort of failed experiment. But we faced that, I repeat myself, we faced that when we were going to run out of electricity. How many states have faced the fact of running out of electricity?
Water, right at the heart of that challenge. Kevin Starr, great to have you with us, and Heather Cooley at Pacific Institute, thank you so much to both of you. This is On Point.